I'll speak from here, it's a little less formal. Thank you very much indeed for that very warm welcome. Thank you for the introduction, thank you for the invitation, and thank you for allowing me into America. Because as the professor in a way was implying in his introduction, we live in a world, and you live in a country, and so do I, in which actually the truth doesn't just dissipate, it's turned on its head. And George Orwell should be alive at this hour to see how the doublespeak has multiplied. I was inexplicably banned from Canada a day or two ago, a day or two after George W. Bush made his maiden professional paid speech in his new career. Some people tried to get the Canadian government to ban him. Maybe even arrest him on the grounds that he killed a lot of people and told a lot of lies to justify it. But of course the Canadian government would have none of that. But I, who have killed no one and who warned that George Bush was going to kill a lot of people and was telling lies about it, persona non grata while he's filling his pockets on the lecture circuit in Canada. That's a small example, personal example, of how the truth is stood on its head. The statistics, sir, that you read about the catastrophe which has been visited on Iraq, 1 million dead Iraqis during the sanctions period to which I referred in the Senate hearing in front of ex-Senator Norman Coleman of Minnesota. I did say in my newspaper column this morning to the Canadian Immigration Minister, Jason Kenney, I always get my man. But as I pointed out in that testimony, one Iraqi every 6 minutes was perishing in the long years of sanctions which were being maintained on what turned out to be entirely false pretenses. And 1 million more have died in the war that followed. It was 100,000 when I addressed Norman Coleman. Now it's 1 million or more. The number of American soldiers killed when I spoke to Norm Coleman has doubled, more than doubled. The number of wounded, maimed, limbless, soldiers who've gone crazy as a result of their experiences in Iraq has multiplied 2, 3, perhaps 4-fold since that day in the Senate in May of 2005. But I'm dwelling on that because I was thinking when you were speaking that Iraq, we're told in the mass media and amongst the political class, has been a success. The surge worked. Petraeus has made everything better. And that narrative, that twisted false narrative, is accepted by many, many people, including many who should know better, people in elected office, people whose job it is to be specialist journalists and commentators, routinely talk as if the worst of the problems in Iraq are over, and that thanks to General Petraeus and the surge and so on, things are getting better. But the most extreme example of this Orwellian doublespeak is freshest in my mind because I've just been in Palestine, as my passport shows, and as the young immigration officer at Newark Airport, I think it may have been the very first Palestinian stamp from Rafah, signed by the Palestinian Authority, that he'd seen. But he was very nice about it, I must say. But because I've just been there, it's that doublespeak that I should like to concentrate on most this evening, because actually there is no political issue in the world today in which the truth is so misrepresented as to literally have inverted. This is a story, and I know this is hard to absorb in the United States. It's the sort of thing that creates a backlash, and it's the sort of thing that people protest against, and well, if you're an elected official, you won't be one for much longer if you say what I'm about to say. But I don't have to worry about that. The Palestinians have suffered one of the greatest crimes of the 20th century, now into the 21st, and have suffered considerable injury. What makes the injury harder to bear is the insult that's added to the injury by actually inverting the truth. In fact, it is the Palestinians who are the victims of terrorism, and it is the Israelis who are the perpetrators of terror. Yet, most people in the world have been encouraged to believe that the truth were the opposite of that. So that the mantra of terror, terror, terror is spoken by the people implementing and perpetrating the terror, while their victims lying bloodied on the ground are described as the terrorists. And it's that insult added to the injury which makes the life of the Palestinian, not just materially, extremely difficult, but a source of such frustration as to what can I do about this situation I'm in. Not only has my country been wiped off the face of the map and no longer exists, not only have millions of my people been scattered to the four winds as refugees and exiles, stateless people, passportless people, people without any sense of security at all. Not only have all of these things happened to me and to my people, but I'm the one who's blamed for it. This is a truly unique set of circumstances. And a series of really gigantic lies have had to be constructed in order to continue to baffle, to mystify, to distort public opinion around the world on this subject. And I have, amongst other things, a television program. I had a very important philosopher called Ted Hondrich on my show. It's been pre-recorded. It goes out next Sunday. I'll tell you later how to get it. You have to forgive me. I'm just off the plane and haven't had a chance even to have a cup of coffee. Forgive me, please. This man, very important professor, he said that he was a Zionist. He wasn't the worst kind of Zionist, but he was very clear that he was a Zionist. He believed that the establishment of the State of Israel was right, and that therefore the legitimate defense of the State of Israel was right, and he was one of those who defended it. And when I asked him, why was the establishment of Israel right, he said the following. He said, first of all, the Jewish people had suffered an enormous wrong in the Holocaust, which is, of course, the truth. If the Palestinians have suffered one of the greatest crimes of the 20th century, the Holocaust is the greatest crime of the 20th century. And millions of Jewish people were massacred, subject to pogrom. And their actual annihilation was sought by the European fascists who carried it out. So he said, the first case for the establishment of Israel was the great wrong which had been committed against the Jewish people. And the second reason, he said, was that the Palestinian people had never established themselves as a people. They had not attained sufficient levels of development that their claim of national rights could compete with the European Jews who were by then headed for Palestine. Now, this is a very revealing idea. First of all, it is the idea, I hesitate to say it, in this country, because of course it was practiced here, that European settlers can come, and if the people who are living on the land are less developed than them, well, they can massacre them, and they can destroy them. This is an idea which might have gone unnoticed when the original settlers came from Europe to this country. But it's not something that can go unnoticed in the post-Second World War era when it happened. So it's a perverse idea that if you're more developed than someone, you can go and steal their house. It's an odd basis for a state. But he went on to say that whilst it's now clear that Palestinian civilization was deeper, more developed, and greater than Zionists like he had imagined at the time, it was too late to do anything about it. So it's too late for the millions of Palestinians driven from their land and their homes, and it's too late for them to recover their rights and their land. This is one of the biggest lies that has infected this whole story. That the Jews were a people without a land, and Palestine was a land without a people. On this basic lie, the big Zionist enterprise adventure is based. But of course, it isn't true that Palestine had no people. And its people are evident today in their millions. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were driven from their homes and their lands, and they have now become millions. So, when your country has been taken, its very name erased from the map, when your people have been scattered, you have two choices. You can go into the museum of X nations, and your artifacts can be hung in glass cases. Your garments can be seen by future generations, and they say, oh, look, that's how the Palestinians used to be. Or, as Shakespeare put it in another context, you can take up arms against your sea of troubles and by opposing end them. Which is the more dignified response? Which response would we take ourselves? It's always useful, isn't it, to walk a mile in the other fellow's shoes. If someone arrived here and took our country and drove us away and lived in our house and refused to allow us to return, would we resignedly shrug and go off to the museum? Or would we fight for that which was ours? And that's what the Palestinians have done. They have done it through the Renaissance, which began in the early 60s, actually, and owed a very great deal to President Yasser Arafat and his revival of Palestinian national identity and national spirit. He's come and gone, and many things have changed in the Palestinian arena, not all of them by any means for the better. But that Palestinian identity is now so strong that it will never be extinguished. That's why I say to the Canadians and anyone else who thinks that you can, by banning or by sanctioning or by bombing, that you can destroy this national identity and its wish to return and fructify on its own homeland, you're making a very serious mistake. Because I have lived a considerable period of this subject. I have been involved since 1975, almost 35 years in this cause. I know, I can promise anyone here who regards themselves as a friend of Israel, I can promise them, no amount of sanctions or war or brutality is going to break and or destroy this new Palestinian identity which has arisen generation now after generation. So we have a problem. We have two people who are absolutely determined to have the same small piece of land. And it's a very, very small piece of land. It's smaller than a single park, for example, in South Africa. The Kruger National Park is bigger than all of Israel, Palestine, 1948-1967 borders. It's a very small piece of land in which now some 8 million people live, and several million others have a right to live, because of course the Palestinian refugees have every right to return to their homes. So how are we going to solve this problem? Well, there were three possible ways. The first was advanced by President Arafat, which was that there should be two states for these two peoples living side by side. I always supported that because I was a supporter of Arafat, which is important for later in this story. I supported the Oslo Agreement. I supported the idea that was signed for on the White House lawn that would allow the Palestinians to build a state on just 22%, just over one-fifth of the country that had once always all been theirs, and 22% of the worst land, by and large, incidentally, leaving the fertile plains and the green hills and most of the sea and much of the water to the Israeli colonists who had taken it by force. That was one way of solving it. That agreement was signed. And now 14 years or more have elapsed. And not only has that agreement not been implemented, but measures have been taken which make its implementation practically impossible. The building of the apartheid wall, declared illegal by the International Court, yet still rising ever higher and reaching ever further into Palestinian land. The extraordinary thickening of Zionist settlements in occupied Palestinian land, absolutely illegal activity, which is nonetheless permitted by the international community, not just permitted, but, well, again, I hesitate to say it here, but paid for by you. These settlements, and especially what has happened to Jerusalem, have made the division of this small land into two states, in my opinion, practically impossible. The second option, therefore, is the one that I have come here to advance. And I mentioned South Africa a moment or two ago for a reason. Because when Mandela was released from prison, by the way, Mandela would have to be banned from Canada under the same regulations that I was banned. If you look at the banning order, it actually fits him much more than it fits me. He's actually been imprisoned for terrorist offenses. But when Mandela was released from prison, the Boer settlers from the Orange Free State, they went to see him. They said, look, we've been enemies a long time, and we realize that it's not easy for us to ask you or you to give us what we ask for. But can't we have a white state in the Orange Free State? The blacks can have everything else. Can't we just designate the Orange Free State as a whites only state? And Mandela answered, we don't believe in white states or black states. We believe in democratic states where every person, whatever color they are, can live as equal citizens under the law, with one man, one woman, one vote, electing one government that will govern the whole country. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that as an idea? Who can argue against that? The Zionists are left saying, no, we, Lieberman, who is now the new foreign minister of Israel, he realizes that the march of demography is such that the Jewishness of Israel in the long term is endangered. So he wants actually to ethnically cleanse not the Palestinians under occupation, but the Palestinian Israeli citizens who've got Israeli passports will have to go. Not just Lieberman, by the way. Livni, the former foreign secretary, said before the last elections, admittedly trying to get some of Lieberman's votes, she said that the Israeli Arabs, as she put it, would increasingly have to see their future outside Israel's borders. You see, the paths down which you disappear when you start to think in terms of exclusivist ethnic states, you end up, I'm sorry to say this, especially in this country where the anti-racist movement was led in the 1950s and 60s by Jewish people. Jewish people don't like to think of themselves as racist, and with good reason, because of their role in the anti-fascist and anti-racist movement. But the logic of this exclusivist state ineluctably takes you into a racist position, because you have to say that he can't come back, and he'll have to go, in fact, so that my exclusive position can be maintained and sustained. So I say, by far the best of these three options is for one democratic state between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, in which all the Jews and the Muslims and the Christians can live as equal citizens in a democratic country. I think that we should begin to advance this as being the best solution, because the one thing that no Israeli politician can agree to in terms of the two-state solution is the one thing that's missing from almost all the discourse, and is the one thing that will scupper any deal, which is that the refugees living outside the West Bank and Gaza must have the right to return to their homes. They must have the right to return to their homes. And there are now several million of those. And their homes are not in the West Bank and Gaza. It's very important for people to grasp this. Many do not. There's quite a big population in the West Bank and Gaza now, but only because the Palestinians have been driven out of the rest of Palestine. I mean, for example, during the recent war, to which I shall come in a minute, I was in a debate in Parliament, you can see it on YouTube, in which members were standing up and saying that they had visited Sderot, And the poor people of the Israeli town were the subject of rocket attacks and so on. In fact, it seemed like every member of the British Parliament had visited this little town called Sderot, which tells you of the assiduity of the Zionist lobby in the country. But as I pointed out, 80% of the people in Gaza are refugees. And where are the refugees from? From the very places in Palestine on top of which Sderot and other towns have been built. I mean literally on top, by the way. I literally mean on top. I mean that their villages were destroyed and Israeli towns were literally built on top of them. So the next time you hear about a Palestinian throwing a rocket in an unguided, almost certainly, utterly, militarily ineffective way at Sderot, pause to think that maybe it's because he's a refugee in a concentration camp for the last 60 years and Sderot is built on his village and his land. This question of the return of the refugees is central. I've spent most of my 35 years on this subject, dealing with Palestinians who are not in the West Bank and Gaza and have never been there. Their houses are in Jaffa, in Haifa. Their houses are in Jerusalem. Their houses are in the civilized places in Palestine that our Professor Hondrich on my show inexplicably hadn't noticed when he supported the establishment of the State of Israel. Let me digress, if I may, because I'm with my friend Ron Mackay, my colleague from Britain. He and I met in Lebanon in 1977 and have been working together since, a very long time. Many marriages have come and gone, but we're still together. We're still together. But he and I were in the still smoking ruins of Jenin some years now, 5 years ago now, after the massacre of the camp, which had been smashed in an extraordinary way, pulverized by Sharon's army. And it was still smoking when we got there, and there were still lots of dead people lying underneath the rubble. The smell of death was everywhere. Now, Jenin is the smallest, most dense of the Palestinian refugee camps. It's 1 square kilometer in which 13,000 families live. 13,000 families, this means something like 50 or 60,000 people living in a square kilometer camp. Now, what's special about this camp is not just the massacre that occurred there, not just the resistance to that massacre that was put up there, but from the rooftops of the Jenin camp, you can see Haifa, a shining city on the sea. What's special about that? All the refugees are from Haifa. So for 60 years, they can and have not just been exiled from Haifa, but can climb onto the roof of a rancid, rat-infested refugee camp and see their own houses, see their own gardens, see their own trees being enjoyed by people who came from New York or Brooklyn or London or Paris and who had homes of their own, who already had lives, who already had countries, came and took their country and their house and their trees. And people wonder why from the Jenin camp you get acts of nihilistic violence, self-immolation, suicide bombing and the rest. You have to understand what it's like to have spent 60 years amidst this hovel called the Jenin refugee camp before you can begin to understand why people take the actions that they do, however horrific, however ineffectual, however in the end ultimately pointless those actions are. So for me, the second option, where the refugees can return to their own homes and where the single state will have guarantees for all the religious groups that would be within the state, underpinned by a democratic constitution and equality before the law, is the solution I think that we should push for. But there is a third option. And I'm sorry to tell you, it's the option that's the most likely to be chosen. When the Israeli people voted for Netanyahu and Lieberman, they voted for war. There's no other way of putting that. They could have voted for people who had just visited 22 days and nights of devastating war on Gaza, but they wanted a government more extreme than that. That's not to say there are no supporters of justice and peace in Israel. Of course there are. And in fact, many of them are more heroic than supporters of justice and peace in the neighboring Arab countries, for whom a couple of shots usually keeps them in their houses. And that's why you get bigger demonstrations in Tel Aviv than you do in Cairo, for example, against the repression of the Palestinian people. But the good, progressive, peace-loving, justice-supporting Israelis are small in number and becoming fewer. Make no mistake, the choice of Netanyahu and Lieberman by the Israeli electorate is a declaration of war against the Palestinian people in the occupied territories, inside the Green Line, and as we saw from the news today, in Lebanon and elsewhere. Israel will reach out and kill, murder, assassinate, and wreak havoc and destruction in pursuit of this chimera that the Palestinian cause is somehow going to just fade away. The idea that after all this sacrifice and struggle, the Palestinian people are going to one day say, oh well, we tried. Forget it, it's been marvelous. And just walk away. It's such an absurd idea. Yet it is undoubtedly the idea that underpins the mentality of people like Netanyahu, that if you strike and strike and strike hard enough and often enough, that the will of the people to resist will be broken. So, what does this declaration of war mean? Well, it means more insecurity and more blood for the Israelis themselves. Because, of course, it's a two-way street when you embark on war. People can and will fight you back. It means dreadful things lie ahead for the Palestinian people under occupation. But I want to concentrate now on what it means for us. Because what are we going to do about it? I'm conscious that I'm in the country which makes it all possible, and I come from the country which authored the whole tragedy in the first place. So we kind of have between us a special responsibility to try and deal with this, yeah? I sit every day in the Houses of Parliament where Mr. Balfour, on behalf of one people, promised a second people the land which belonged to a third people. Even by imperialist standards, that was quite a performance. Now, we authored that tragedy with that declaration and the mandate which we exercised thereafter. But if we're culpable as the original sinners, I'm afraid you take the biscuit. The biscuit is yours. Do you know what that means, taking the biscuit? Does that travel across the Atlantic? You get my point? Because every rocket that's fired into the refugee camps in Gaza, every bullet that fires into the head of a Palestinian child in the West Bank, every brick of every settlement, every brick of the wall, everything that Israel has, she gets from you. Everything. This small country of 5 million is the biggest recipient of American aid in the world. 5 million. India has 1 billion people. Yeah? Egypt even has 70 million people. They get a lot of United States aid, but nothing like what the 5 million Israelis get. And that's just the state aid. The individual, private, philanthropic fundraising of the Zionist organizations almost doubles what the American taxpayer gives. The assembly lines of McDonnell Douglas and the arms companies practically run all the way to Israel. The latest military technology, even before your own armed forces get it, is in the hands of the Israelis. When I was in Gaza last week, I visited a mosque which was destroyed, its dome sitting upside down. And when I looked in the ruins of the mosque, I saw the ruins of the orphans' school. Orphans' school. It's not enough to be an orphan in Gaza, but 7 Israeli missiles smash it to pieces, killing children and teachers, and now the children are learning sitting out on the grass. I mention it because I picked up the pieces of the shrapnel from the missiles, and they came from you. You paid for them. You even made them. Your companies built them. And they ended killing orphans in Gaza over the last few weeks. So what are we going to do about this? Are we going to allow Israel to elect ever more repulsive, right-wing, aggressive governments, but still write the checks? Are we going to allow them to dominate the discourse in the world so that someone like me is described as a supporter of terrorism, while someone like Lieberman is described as a foreign minister and as a statesman for whom a red carpet should be rolled out? Are we going to continue to allow Israel to be in breach of more United Nations Security Council resolutions than all the other countries of the world put together? All of them put together. Iraq was destroyed in the name of United Nations Security Council resolutions, even though, as it turned out, she wasn't breaking any. Israel is in breach of more than all the countries in the world. She's not punished, she's rewarded with more money and more weapons and more respectability. What are we going to do about that? Because it's not just that we have a moral responsibility. It's not just because it would be the right thing to do to ask our politicians to think again about this approach. It's not just that. It's that we found, didn't we, in both of our countries, that this policy of double standards and injustice is so poisoning the well amongst the Muslims around the world that many of them, millions of them, have begun to hate us so much that they're ready to exchange their lives for many of ours in atrocious acts like 9/11, like 7/7 in London a year or so after that. My point is, we have a legitimate national interest in resolving this Palestinian question on the basis of justice, not just because it's right, but because it's in our own interests to do so. And there's nothing wrong with a government acting in its own interests. I sat with my friend Ron on a bus in Beirut in 1977, shows you what a great forecaster I am. I said, this will be over in 20 years because America will realize that actually it will create such extremism in the Arab world as a result of its endless support for Israel, it's bound to change its policy. 1997 came and went, my 20 years was up. 2007 has come and gone, another decade. But that extremism that I predicted, that fanaticization, that sowing of hatred and bitterness and despair amongst more than a billion people around the world has reached crisis proportions for all of us. Why do you think that medieval obscurantists like Bin Laden and the like can achieve the purchase, the traction that they have? Because the Muslims look around at the double standards of the West, at the corpulent corruption of their own puppet presidents and corrupt kings, and they hear the call. And if there was an election, I know it's a difficult thing to imagine an election in Saudi Arabia. But if there was an election in Saudi Arabia, this Bin Laden would do quite well, you know. He'd certainly beat the current incumbent if it was a free vote. Now, we don't want this kind of extremism and fanaticism, obscurantism to be taking over the Muslim world. Not just because it's bad for them, it's also bad for us. And it's about time the United States government started acting in the interests of the United States in this matter and not in the interests of other people. I'll give you just one last example. I don't know the man, and I hope I'm not ending his career. But when President Obama asked this Charles Freeman to head the National Intelligence Council in the United States, a man who had been an ambassador for the United States in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, a man who was an expert on the region, an expert on intelligence, I thought that's quite a good appointment. And I turned my back and went to Gaza and came back to discover that the nomination has been shredded and destroyed and that Freeman is finished. Because those who think that they're acting in the interests of the people of Israel decided that Obama cannot be allowed to deviate in any way from the rigid tramlines of the policy that has been pursued over the last 8 years, indeed far, far longer than that in truth. Well, I say this to President Obama, who's, I have every respect and admiration for him. I supported him when nobody in Britain could pronounce his name, and even Fox News was still calling him Barack Osama. So I say this to him with all respect. There's no point in closing Guantanamo Bay. If you don't change America's policy towards Palestine, you'll need to open Guantanamo Bay again. You'll have to open Guantanamo Bays all over the world. Because if you don't change the flaw at the heart of America's relationship to the Muslim world, then nothing is going to change. Everything is going to get worse. And nowadays, as they know even in Hollywood, the empire strikes back. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.
Brief and to the point would be just absolutely splendid. The next question, please, ma'am.
Yes, you got into Gaza. How can we break that blockade? What any, do you have any insight into whether Rafah can be broken through or what to do?
Okay, good. Please, sir.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. When he was speaking earlier, he mentioned that Israel might try for Lebanon again. Well, in 2006, considering there's no real political connection that I'm aware of between Palestine and Lebanon, I was just wondering what he based that on.
Yeah. Well, they killed a leading Palestinian militant in Lebanon today. That's what I was referring to. I don't know the details, but that's news from today. I wasn't suggesting that they're going to invade Lebanon again. I think they would be exceedingly unwise to do that. On the question of Hamas is an important one at a gathering like this of clever people, of people who know a lot. The problem is outside, this word Hamas is waved like the word terror is waved, like the word Hezbollah is waved, or Al-Qaeda, or Taliban, as if all these things were the same, and as if this undifferentiated face of what they portray as Islamic extremism was something with which there could be no dialogue. Now, let me put my cards on the table. I tried to, by implication earlier, I'm not a supporter of Hamas. If I had a vote in Palestine, it wouldn't be for Hamas. But I long ago abandoned the idea that you can choose other people's representatives for them. This is a colonial idea. The British tried it in the north of Ireland for many years. The Boers tried it in South Africa. The whites tried it in Zimbabwe. You look for a stooge to relate to, and you call that a settlement. Well, the people who actually represent the party to the conflict are kept in exile or in prison, or you pretend they don't exist. In Mrs. Thatcher's time, Gerry Adams, who the last time I looked was sitting with the president in the Oval Office on St. Patrick's Day, he wasn't allowed to speak on British TV. They had to employ actors to speak his words. You were allowed to see his face, his lips moving, but it was an actor who was speaking the words. Don't ask me what that was all about. But that was an example of the British trying to choose who represents the Irish. It's doomed. It's stupid, and most importantly, it's doomed. So, I'm not a supporter of Hamas, but the people elected Hamas. And that's what the last 2 years of suffering and siege and starvation have all been about. The people voted for a party that Britain and America and Israel don't like, so let's starve the people to death to teach them a lesson. What kind of democracy is that? So, when I went to Gaza, I took 110 British vehicles, which became 250 vehicles, quite a convoy, by the time we reached Palestine. And I gave the keys to the government in Palestine. I didn't give them to Hamas. I didn't give them to my pinups or my favorites. I gave them to the government, elected by the people of Palestine. What's wrong with that? If there's anyone from the FBI here, what's wrong with that? Who else would you give them to? Who else would you give 250 vehicles full of wheelchairs and medicine and ambulances and fire engines and nappies for children who don't have them and clothes for women that haven't got them and blankets to keep people warm because their houses have been destroyed? Who else would you give it to except the elected government? And that's what we did. Now, if you want my honest opinion, most people voted for Hamas not because they want to see Palestine an Islamic State. They voted for Hamas because of the incompetence, failure, and corruption of the Fatah government in the PNA, the Palestine National Authority, and because of the failure of the Arab nationalist trend within the PLO to deliver any success in recovering Palestine from the occupation. Of course, there will be some who want Palestine to be either like Turkey or like Saudi Arabia. I don't think there are any takers for it to be like the Taliban in Afghanistan. This is a highly educated and sophisticated people in Palestine. I don't think there are many takers for that. But if you said to the Palestinian people, as a whole, in the West Bank, Jerusalem, Gaza, in the refugee camps around the world, and in the exile, in this room, and in other rooms, would you like a democratic and secular country from the river to the sea where everyone lived as equals of the other? They would grab that offer with open arms and take it to their breasts. But before I finish with your point, I'd like to say this. One of the most idiotic things that I find in the political class and amongst commentators is the conflation of Al-Qaeda and Hamas, for example. There's no comparison between these two organizations. Al-Qaeda is a pan-Islamic revolutionary organization which wants to overthrow all existing regimes and recreate the caliphate as existed before the fall of the Ottoman Empire. Hamas just wants to liberate its country. It has no other ambitions. It doesn't care what length the girls' skirts are in Amsterdam or how we live in Manhattan. It has no view on these things. It just wants to liberate its tiny piece of land from illegal and violent military occupation. And if that's true there, it's also true, I digress, but it's also true in Afghanistan. If you conflate what they call the Taliban, which is in fact the Afghan resistance to foreign occupation, with Al-Qaeda, well, you'll never solve this problem. These two forces do not have the same agenda. And if you pretend that they do, then you're going to be fighting that war for another 100 years. Now, the lady who asked about breaking the siege, I believe it's a moral imperative to break this siege. I must tell you, the state of life in Gaza now is almost beyond description. And I speak as someone who knows Palestinian suffering very well. The people are hungry. They don't have bread to eat. Even I stayed in a hotel, they had to send out to get tea and coffee for me, because this hotel had nothing. No food, no tea, no coffee, no soap in the hotel. How the people are living in their houses, in the camps, is that they're living on the edge of starvation. People are eating from the garbage heaps, from other people's refuse in Gaza. The hospitals have no electricity because the electricity is cut off most of the time. They can't get enough medicine, medical supplies, doctors. Doctors are kept outside the border in Rafah, dozens of them waiting to go into work and can't get in. The state of the Palestinians under occupation in Gaza is so serious that it is a moral imperative on all of us to beat a path to Rafah and to force the Egyptian authorities by force of moral and democratic pressure to open their gates. And that's what we did. People say to me, why didn't you just sail all these vehicles and material to Alexandria and then drive to Rafah and take it through? The answer is, I had to give the Egyptian authorities three long weeks to think about how they were going to handle this convoy when it arrived. And that by the time it arrived, it had behind it such public goodwill and publicity and so on that it was very difficult for them to stop it. And they didn't stop it. And I'm grateful to them for not stopping it. It was difficult for them to stop 300 Brits. It would be much harder for them to stop 300 Americans. There's no reason why you here in the United States cannot raise funds, go to Egypt, buy things that are urgently needed in Palestine, hire trucks to take it there, and drive to the Rafah border and ask Egypt to open it. And trust me, they found it hard to deal with me. They found it hard to refuse me. They would find it very much harder, because Egypt gets a lot of money from the United States. They'd find it harder to refuse you. And you should do it. There should be a Viva Palestina convoy coming from all four corners of the earth to Palestine. We made a drop in the ocean. We lifted everyone's spirits. We boosted everyone's morale, but the material aid that we were able to gather in 4 weeks as just ordinary people was small. I wrote to the kings and the rich people in the Arab world and so on. We didn't even get a reply. The aid that we collected came from the poorest people in England, came from the ethnic minority populations in England who are the poorest people in England, but they dug deep into their pockets. They took stuff from their own homes, their own shops, their own stalls, and so on, and they took it all the way to Palestine. And I hope that you'll do the same in the United States. Thanks.
Given that the one-state solution is not on the agenda of those people that are actually negotiating peace right now, how much manipulation